From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, politics dominate our weekly roundtable discussion today, from the ever-changing Democratic presidential race, harsh words from state Republicans about abortion, and Congressman Neal's call for President Trump's tax returns.
This is really about policy and not about politics. I think Democratic presidents as well as Republican presidents ought to release their tax forms.
Also today, psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb draws back the curtain on secrets, shame, and what therapists really think about their patients.
If you show me your humanity, you will be the most interesting person in the world. But if you hide, I'm going to get really bored.
Plus, surfs up on Styrofoam, the New Hampshire man who made a surfboard of Dunkin' cups.
It's really great to look down at it while you're standing on it and say, yeah, that's 700 cups and it's cruising, it's working.
That's all coming up next on a special Radio Boston from WBUR City Space.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, and we're broadcasting today live from WBUR City Space. I want to welcome our live audience. Thanks for being with us. Also, we'll now introduce our panelists for our Friday Week in Review. Tom Keene is a former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page, Cognoscenti. Welcome, Tom.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical and a former Boston City Councilor as well. Hi, Tito.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So we're going to start with the Democratic race for president and some of the newest developments there. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg appealed to young people at Northeastern University this week.
You have to hold elected officials responsible. The reason they don't respond to the policy preferences of young people is because they're not afraid of young people. They will be if you fire them.
On the other end of the age spectrum, former Vice President Joe Biden, who is not yet officially in the race, but again addressing a growing number of complaints about making women feel uncomfortable when he touches them.
Social norms have begun to change, they've shifted, and the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it. I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility.
Meantime, Congressman Tim Ryan announces he's in. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton is still thinking about it. So where does this race stand? So, Tom Keene, I'm wondering, what's your read on Mayor Buttigieg? Is he catching fire? Is it just sort of flavor of the week here? I mean, we did hear about Beto O'Rourke, and everyone wanted Beto, and now where does he stand? Is it just 15 minutes here?
I'm kind of with the flavor of the week. Mm-hmm. And this race in the Democratic side is shaping up to be just like what we saw 4 years ago on the Republican side. And if you remember back then, it was, you know, you have one crazy candidate after another coming to the top, and all of a sudden that's the person who's the front runner. And then for whatever reason, they collapse. And I'm certainly seeing that right now. And quite frankly, I also think that if I were Donald Trump, I'd be really happy right now in the way that this field is shaping up.
Well, yeah, it sounds like that. Tito, what are your thoughts? Do you think that Buttigieg can turn out young people? Everyone wants the millennials, right?
Yes, and I think those individuals who have the gravitas, excitement, are going to introduce and bring young people into the mix. I think the Democrats erred last time by trying to socially engineer the race and having Saturday night debates, not for nothing. I literally watched more hours of Republican debates last go round. Don't tell anybody that. It'll be our secret. Then Democratic debates. So I think we need to give Mayor Pete his due. I think he's bringing a lot of gravitas and energy to the table, and allow people, this is what Democrats should do, allow people to try to sell themselves to the electorate versus calling them out and cutting them off from day one.
So he's more than flavor of the month.
I like the brother.
Yeah.
Right?
I like him too, Tito. I'm not saying that. I just think you're going to see a whole parade of candidates here who are going to attract some attention from people. They'll rise to the top, and then we're going to kind of go on to the next one.
And that's what this is what we missed last time. We need to vet somebody in the primary. They need to be wholly vetted in the primary. And we missed out on that opportunity last time. And today, Tom and I actually have an announcement That we are both...
We're both running, right?
We're both running right now. So it's up to 26 now.
Feels like 86.
Okay.
It really does.
But I want to bring up something again about Buttigieg. Let's go back to him. He's getting some criticism, right, for using the term all lives matter. And this was during his State of the City address in 2015. And here he is in New York yesterday explaining his changing thinking about that term.
Unfortunately, it was not obvious to everybody that black lives were being valued the same. And so that is the contribution of Black Lives Matter, and it's a reason why, since learning about how that phrase was being used to push back on that activism, I've stopped using it in that context.
Your take on that, Tito Jackson?
I think, first, black lives do matter, and it is critical that we have candidates who can evolve in their thinking, that don't have to double down every single time. And by the way, candidates who sometimes say, I'm sorry, that to me shows a maturity, and it's a juxtaposition to what we have on offer in the White House right now. That to me shows leadership, and I give Mayor Pete his props for stepping up and saying that Black Lives Matter.
Not a career destroyer, Tom?
No, not a career destroyer. And I mean, everyone knows that the All Lives Matter formulation was an attempt to put down the Black Lives Matter movement. But I think I agree with Tito, which is, people in public life say things. You're on stage all the time. You're going to say something inappropriate, something wrongheaded. The key thing is to pick up on it, apologize for it, and move on.
Well, let's move on to Vice President Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden. We played a piece of tape from him at the beginning of the program. That was from a video that was posted on Twitter. Do you think that these concerns about what he says are being mindful of boundaries of personal space, are these a career killer? Tito Jackson. Candidacy killer, I suppose I should say.
Well, no, I don't believe, again, I believe that everyone should step to the front and put what they have on offer to everyone. I get it. What he should have said, if I help, I want to help you, Uncle Joe. I'm sorry. Hmm. Right? So an apology there. And then, honestly, the real move there would have been to step the game up and speak about the fact that 1 in 4 women are assaulted in their lifetime. Speak about the fact that men have to step up and take personal responsibility for these interactions and all of the power dynamics that are involved here. So he had an opportunity to step forward and lead. I don't believe that he actually took that opportunity. And I think we get into the minutia about what the person or the intent of the person was when they had that interaction. He has an opportunity still to this day, I believe, to step forward and actually lead in this space. And I think he would have some grounds to do that and get some traction stepping forward in that way.
I want to play a piece of tape here of President Trump. You may have seen the tweet from President Trump. It was mocking Biden's video on Twitter. And this afternoon, President Trump was on the White House lawn, and under the roar of a helicopter, this is what he said.
No, I don't see Joe Biden as a threat. No, I don't see him as a threat. I think he's only a threat to himself. I just don't see him as a threat.
Threat to himself.
I have no idea what that means.
Well, is he harming himself by making these statements, these continued statements about what he's doing, and what does that say? Not just, I think, about Biden's candidacy, but sort of our politics right now, too, right?
Right. I think, unfortunately, I really think that Biden's time was 4 years ago, and I really wish he'd gotten into the race then. Instead, as Tito says, it was kind of socially engineered by the Democratic Party, and we just had a nominee that sailed on through. I do think, actually, that this time around, I wouldn't say this is necessarily the career killer, but I think Donald Trump has shown himself to be a master at tearing into people for the slightest of reasons and bringing them down. And I really fear that Biden would be in that position, even though, of course, Trump has no position to talk about how well he treats women. It doesn't matter. He just goes on the attack.
But I think Donald Trump oftentimes... when he tries to address the issue, like in this case, I think he's deathly afraid of Joe Biden. I really do.
Really?
I think that in Donald Trump's mind, that Joe Biden would be someone that would be formidable to him. And again, when Donald Trump says one thing, I have a tendency to believe that he probably means the other.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly right in the sense that there's a lot of candidates that seem to be coming from the coast, and we already know the coasts are going to vote Democratic. Biden does have that ability to appeal more to middle America.
Right. Right. Well, you know, we also have a piece of tape from Biden, and this is from today. He was speaking in Washington to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Construction Conference, and he gave someone a hug on stage, and this was a joke he gave after. Let's listen.
I just want you to know I had permission to hug Lonnie.
So when you hear something like that, do you say, is he not getting it here? Or is that being overly sensitive? Because you know people will say that, right? He made a joke about this. Not a joke. It's not funny. He doesn't get it. Thoughts there? Tom?
I think that to a degree he doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. And I think this actually hurts him. I think there are clearly people out there who are very offended by his behavior personally. There's also some who are not. But I think he does, by making a joke of it and making light of it, he's making light of what they say is their own hurt.
And it's important to take this serious. And it's important as a leader to lead in this space. And in particular, in a day and age that we look at all of the disparities across the board around gender, it is critical that someone who served in that role as vice president step forward and show guys how to lead, challenge other men, challenge men who are making decisions about board of directors, making decisions about hiring, making decisions about pay. So he has to take it serious. And if he chooses not to take it serious, then I do believe he could easily become a candidate of the past. Step up now and do the right thing in this space.
You think he's going to run?
Come on. I think he has a lifetime pension, right?
Right, yes.
So
yes,
I don't think he's kind of just doing this.
Well,
he's,
there are some people saying this morning he's not going to. This is going to push him out. You guys both
so he just okay. just wanted to stop by because were his lights blinking?
Well, I think the way I'd formulate that is that he is running until he tells you that he's not running. Hmm. He hasn't made an official announcement. But at any point, people can withdraw from a race. Absolutely, at this point, he is running.
Okay. Somebody who we don't know that for certain yet, Congressman Seth Moulton, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, he's said to be considering a run. He's been going around the country, going to some of the important states, and he was on the NPR show 1A this week, again, saying he hasn't decided yet, but I want to listen to a little bit of that program. Let's listen.
We need a president who understands that patriotism means service, that leadership requires moral courage, to make sure that every American has a job in the new economy, not the old, to get weapons of war off our streets, and to make sure that our planet doesn't have an expiration date, to make sure that Americans are safe and secure and America is strong in the world. It's going to be hard.
That sounds to me like a candidate. What are your thoughts?
You know, I listened to all those descriptions of what he thinks we need to have in a president, and I am betting that Seth Moulton thinks he fits all of that, right? I mean, I think he's going to run.
And I see from a lot of the people in the audience here today, they're shaking their head. I also think, you know, the fact that he's a veteran, the fact that he has uplifted other veterans into the ranks of elected officials, and the fact that he has also been willing to step up inside the Democratic Party and challenge folk. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley also had to step up as recent as this past week to say the DCCC and to push the party to do the right thing. Those are, it's, I think, oftentimes easier to lead externally and really difficult to lead internally inside your party. And I think Seth Moulton has distinguished himself in that space. And I don't, he's kind of handsome too.
Well, Okay. But let's.
And he's got better hair than our current president.
He's got better hair than our current president. Well, okay. Well, I want to talk about another member of our local delegation. This is Congressman Richard Neal, chair of House Ways and Means, requested 6 years of the president's tax returns and those from his companies. We have he spoke with WBUR, and we have a little bit of the tape of him making that request. Let's listen.
This is really about policy and not about politics. I think Democratic presidents as well as Republican presidents ought to release their tax forms. We tried very hard to refrain from even linking it to the Mueller report, which we did not.
Tito Jackson, is this a wise move on the part of Democrats?
I absolutely believe it's a wise move on the part of the Democrats. This has been a lingering issue over the course of time. It also speaks to transparency and really the question as to whether or not, one, is he as rich as he says he is? But two, has there been bad acts on behalf of the president as well as his companies? We all get, and even as a local elected official, I'm not even going to talk about my parking tickets, right? So we all are vetted. And this is the one person from an economic perspective who still is not vetted. And by the way, whose kids are working in the White House, still making millions and millions of dollars from these Trump companies. It has to happen. It's the right play, and they should push it all the way up to whatever court and make the courts rule on this issue.
Yeah, so I think when Richie Neal says this isn't about politics, it's about policy, he's not speaking the truth, obviously. Mm-hmm. This is about politics. This is about a way for the Democrats to try to hurt Donald Trump, maybe by showing he's not that rich, maybe by showing he's fudged on a variety of things. I have no idea what. I am not. I am certain that Trump is going to fight this as far as he can possibly fight this, and I actually think he'll win. I mean, it's interesting. The Constitution tells you what the qualifications for a candidate have to be. And I think that the way a court would ultimately rule is that you can't start to impose new qualifications, such as releasing your tax returns, in order to be president. Even though we may be able to do it for almost every other governor and state rep and state senators, I suspect you won't be able to do it for president.
Okay, I want to make sure we have enough time to do some local political stories this week. Massachusetts Republicans and their strong words about a Democratic bill that would expand access to abortions. Among the things that bill would do, remove parental consent requirements that are now in place in this state. And the state Republican Party chair, Jim Lyons, wrote a letter and described the bill as radical infanticide. Governor Charlie Baker has said he does not favor any new exceptions for abortions after 24 weeks, which this bill would provide. And also, at the same time, he signed an emergency bill this week to replace federal funding, replace federal family planning funding. So I want to play a little bit here of the governor, because I want to talk about the spot that he might find himself in if the head of the Republican Party in Massachusetts is being so critical. Let's listen to the governor.
I don't believe in questioning motives. I don't believe in questioning character. And I think the inflated language that exists on all sides in politics has made it much harder for people to do the work that they're supposed to do on behalf of the people they serve and they represent. And I do support current law here in Massachusetts, and always have, and will defend it, but I don't support late-term abortions.
So is Charlie Baker in a tough spot here, Tito Jackson?
Well, he's the governor. He's always in a tough spot, right? But I think the Progressive Caucus has done a lot of really good work, not only on this issue and bringing forward these issues, but issues across the board that we have not actually been speaking about. And so I believe that when we look at issues like parental consent and these obstacles that women have, I think there needs to be some progress in that space. But the real question is, how does the governor navigate with his party as well as obviously most of the Democrats there? It is a difficult space, but I also think it shows the strength of the progressive side and caucus at the state house right now that did really well in this past election and are able to move issues in ways that had not been moved before.
So you don't think that this is sort of maybe the local GOP being emboldened by what's happening nationally?
I think it's completely the local GOP being emboldened. This infanticide thing, and that's the hot button issue, right? I mean, it's the consent for under 18 is nowhere near as flagrant an issue, and it's not going to get people as upset as the so-called infanticide issue, the late-term abortion thing. It worked really well in Virginia, right? And the governor got really humiliated by it. And I think the GOP really is seeing that this is potentially a reviving a wedge issue, a classic wedge issue. I thought it was interesting. I think clearly Baker feels that pressure. His comments were really interesting because he said, I don't want to get into sort of all the rhetoric around this. But it's also quite clear he's coming down on the Republican side, at least as now being voiced, of not changing the law at all. I happen to think he's incorrect on that, but I think he's really feeling that pressure.
You know, we spoke with the former head of the Mass GOP, Jennifer Nassour, on this program this week. And this, I want you to listen to a little bit of what she said about perhaps a more conservative shift within the Massachusetts Republican Party. She said, actually, she feels that the party is no longer the party that she came from. So let's listen.
Charlie Baker is still the head of the party, despite the fact that Jim Lyons was elected. And Jim Lyons was elected by a majority, a substantial majority of the state committee. But that state committee is represented by 80 men and women. And that's a small population of people who consider themselves Republicans. And I think that the typical Republican still in Massachusetts is a person who is fiscally conservative and socially more libertarian.
You agree with that, Tom? Is that, would you say that that's accurate? We still have, you know, pretty socially liberal Republicans. I can't remember the joke about a Republican in Massachusetts, but I know that many folks say they'd be a Democrat in most other states.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is a unique breed of Republican that we have here in Massachusetts. We have a unique history of governors who have reflected that, right? I mean, from Bill Weld and you know, Frank Sargent, and going back quite a bit. But within Massachusetts, there is, it's quite clear within the GOP, there is this growing, more conservative wing that is increasingly vocal and is increasingly seizing power and is increasingly willing to challenge Charlie Baker. They call Charlie Baker the Rhino, you know, Republican in name only. Mm-hmm. And that is the criticism that they're leveling at him. I do think, I mean, Charlie Baker really is a Democrat as far as I'm concerned. He managed to get in as Republican, but almost everything he has done really reflects the fact that he is probably a moderate Democrat.
I want to just bring something up, though, because this is an interesting story this week. The Baker administration pushing back against newly elected Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, and she put out a new policy statement, 65 pages of policies last week, saying her office will dismiss some low-level offenses. She's going to push for diversion to try to reduce mass incarceration. And so we hear from Charlie Baker, Secretary of Public Safety, Tom Turco, this week, saying that those policies could cause all kinds of problems, put kids at risk, compromise efforts to protect crime victims, worsen the opioid epidemic. And really, he thinks she should scale those back a bit. Tito Jackson, your thoughts on that?
First, I do need to disclose that I helped Rachel Rollins on her campaign. Mm-hmm. What I would say is Rachel Rollins is duly elected. And she was recently elected, vetted by the people of the county. And this was central to what she ran on. And so when we think about the $60,000 a year that we spend incarcerating people, and most of the time incarcerating people based on things related to poverty or addiction, that's what she's speaking about. In Suffolk County, there's over 1,000 unsolved murders in the city of Boston. The resources need to go to the higher level crimes, and we're not saying, and I don't believe she's saying that people should not be held accountable, but there are different ways that don't require individuals to be incarcerated or go through the courts or be locked up. We lag behind as a state relative to criminal justice reform, and we even lag behind some of the southern states, such as Texas and other states. We have a lot of work to do here, and if we're serious about criminal justice reform, we actually have to support Rachel Rollins in this space.
But you know, I was talking with someone about this, someone who was a very strong supporter of hers just last week after her 65-page policy proposal came out. And he said, you know, he's really concerned. He thought she might be underestimating the how sophisticated some people might be to try to get around things and be diverted. And if they don't have the threat of incarceration hanging over their head, it could lead to lawlessness.
Well, so there's really two pieces to what her proposal is. One is diversion, which is, in other words, the penalty is not going to jail, but is some other penalty, community service, fines, restitution, what have you. The second piece is her decision to make a whole category of crimes that she will not prosecute under any circumstances, that the default position is I'm not going to prosecute. That, I think, becomes the vastly more controversial element here. So when she says, you know, you shoplift, we're not going to prosecute. Malicious destruction of property, we're not going to prosecute. Intent to distribute drugs, we're not going to prosecute. That basically gives free rein to people to say, well, then there's no penalty whatsoever to do it. I think that's going to become a political hot button.
But didn't she say these things before she got elected?
She said them during her campaign.
Right.
And she said them, and if you want to go back to the Boston Herald, you see her getting hit on these issues. So when it comes down to, and this is, again, people are duly elected. They ran a campaign, put these issues forward, and if we truly believe in criminal justice reform, if we truly believe in moving our city forward and not putting continuing to lock folks up and throw away the key, understand, by the way, it also she also states, if you harm someone, you're getting locked up. So there's not this, there has to be the tools in order to take care of and focus on the higher level crimes and also do right by and give opportunities, chances, and help to those individuals who are on the lower level.
Yeah. I mean, I will tell you, just because she was duly elected doesn't mean people can't push back on it. Donald Trump told us he was going to build a wall. Doesn't mean people are going to push back on it because he was duly elected.
No, seriously.
But
it's March. It's March.
Right.
She just got into office.
And she just put out this 60-page memo, which I have actually read the entire thing. And I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. I followed that election very closely. Yes, she had floated the idea out there, but it sounded more like diversion. Now it really is sounding like you'll get off scot-free. And the default position, I mean, if you run a retail store and she is saying shoplifting is okay, it's going to be tough to run a retail store.
I just got to tell you one story. A young man in Tedeschi's, his buddies decide to snatch some stuff from there. The owner won't give him his $20 back. He gets in a fight with the owner, he wins the fight. He gets a charge of assault with a deadly weapon, shot foot, armed robbery. This young man was sentenced. I think they gave him 10 years. He spent 6 years in the DDU unit. This young man was in a unit for other people, for people who assault other prisoners. He came out, and he now has 4 years on his probationary time. He was 17 when this happened.
And
he copped.
And
by the way,
ridiculous.
He didn't get a plea. He had to serve the whole amount of time. His life is inextricably and irreversibly changed based on what's happening. And we have to have people like Rachel Rollins who are willing to step forward and have a backbone. And change is going to cause pushback. But I agree with the fact that she needs to step forward and do the right thing
But plainly, the right circumstance in the case you described, what should have been done was a diversion program, obviously not put into incarceration. But they really are two separate issues. One is the diversion. One is the decision not to prosecute at all. That's, I think, the thing that's going
to
become the
hot
button.
And I think we are going to probably have this debate more in the future. Rachel Rollins, I think, is actually having a press conference about this at 4 o'clock today that WBUR is covering. So this will continue to be an issue. So we're going to have to stop it there. But I want to thank both of you for being with us. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, regular contributor to WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page, Cognoscenti. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical and a former Boston City Councilor as well. Thanks to you.
R.I.P. to Nipsey Hussle.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston live from WBUR City Space.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, broadcasting live from WBUR City Space. Well, it's an all-too-common sight in New England, styrofoam dunking cups littering public areas. To many of us, this is annoying garbage, but to Corey Nolan, it's inspiration. He created a Dunkin' Styrofoam surfboard, and he and his board are with us here. Welcome to Radio Boston, Corey.
Thank you.
So how did this idea of taking a bunch of coffee cups from the garbage and turn them into a surfboard come to you?
So there's a company out of California called Visla. Each summer, they put out a calling for people to make something for surfing out of garbage. I wanted to come up with a project that was iconic for New England, that also represented a large problem of waste and also was a good source of flotation. So ultimately, I landed on the cups because they're certainly abundant around here.
Did you see them all over the place and think, that's it, eureka?
Yeah, I mean, you know, either people carrying them or you do see them in the street and they're in the trash. They're everywhere.
Okay, so you have this display in front of me here.
Yeah.
That's a lot of flattened pieces of styrofoam Dunkin' cups. Maybe, I don't know, what, 4 inches would you say by four inches thick, maybe 5 inches long?
It should be about 3 inches. That's 20 layers of the vertical part of the cup cut into slices and adhered together with a bio-based epoxy. My wife helped me put the whole thing together in my garage. It took about 2 months to build.
2 months?
Yeah.
So did you just go around collecting cups everywhere? What did you do?
I did a bit. I collected about 1,000. The board itself contains about 700 in total. I collected about 25% of them myself. I also asked friends and family to save them for me, collect them for me, and they really turned out, and they gave me about 3/4 of what I needed.
And then you flattened them all like you did with this little piece that you're showing me here.
Yeah, that's a small piece of the large form, the large mold that I made. Is about 2,800 pieces all told, I had to do it in stages, working with epoxy as time time-sensitive material.
And then seal it all and mold it, or what happens after that?
So essentially I made a surfboard blank. It's a rectangular shape that had the curvature of the board from nose to tail that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I had that full 3-inch by 2-foot by 6-foot piece, I cut it and shaped it with saws and sandpaper and planers and stuff like that to get it to its final form. And wrap the whole thing in fiberglass and epoxy resin like you would a normal surfboard.
I'm told we have some photos or some video of how this was created. And, oh, there we go. So I know our listening audience can't see this, but it's cutting a bunch of cups with a... What are you cutting that with, Corey?
Just a utility blade.
Just a utility blade, yep. Making them all sort of flat, cutting out the round circles on a wooden board here. And... that's how you, look at, and then you line them all up in epoxy and sort of looks like a big plastic rectangle.
Yeah, it's a big mold, yeah. I'm brushing
that's
each piece with epoxy there and laying them in the mold. The shape I made with each one was really helpful in making sure I filled all the voids. Huh.
And so can you actually surf on this surfboard?
Yes, absolutely.
You can.
It sits in my board rack as one of my... quiver. It's there and I choose to ride it.
Huh. It's not too heavy.
It's not, no.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It's about twice as heavy as a board of normal construction. just because of all of the epoxy used to glue all the cups together. But when you're floating on it and you're riding it, you wouldn't know the difference.
So you heard about the contest. Mm-hmm. What happened? You win?
So the contest was, they asked for entries in August, and they had a gala that I was invited to with about 15 others, individuals internationally, in San Juan Capistrano, California. And they gave me second place prize for that.
Second place?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What
Thank
does
you.
Second place get you?
A gift card and a nice bag full of swag. And I had a lovely weekend in California and got to surf out there, and it was great.
That's nice. Yeah. But, you know, we did start at the top talking about Dunkin' cups littering everywhere, and it's a huge problem. And, you know, mm-hmm. we did get a statement from Dunkin' Donuts that said that they commend you mm-hmm. for your creative ingenuity, but also wanted to make sure that we point out that Dunkin' will replace its foam cup with a new double-walled paper cup. So that's
good.
That's the
Certainly
news from Dunkin'.
More recyclable.
Because there's an environmental message here as well.
Absolutely.
What's yeah. that?
Styrofoam is difficult to recycle. It's extremely light for the volume that it takes up and makes it difficult for people to want to do anything with it. You're limited in what you can remake with it. So we're really good at making items that are usable for a short term, often contaminated by food, than to just get thrown out. And people are unsure the lifespan of styrofoam. It was invented like 70 years ago, and all of that styrofoam is basically still around.
Hmm. What's your next project? Do you have one?
I have a few things I'm working on. I'm definitely going to enter again this coming season, but I haven't nailed anything down, and I kind of want to hold off on announcing all that stuff.
Yeah, that's top secret.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Corey Nolan, a surfer from Hampton Falls, New Hampshire, and the creator of the Dunkin' Styrofoam Surfboard. Thanks for being
Thank
with
you.
Us. Stay with us. Coming up, therapist Lori Gottlieb about why we're attached to our secrets. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston, broadcasting live from WBUR City Space.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, broadcasting live from WBUR City Space. Why do people go to therapists? Lori Gottlieb knows a lot about that question, not only because she is a therapist, but also because she's been in therapy herself. Gottlieb has a new book out about this, and she's here to tell us more. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I found it not all that surprising that therapists see therapists. I think that's part of your training, isn't it?
So we do go to therapists as part of our training because we have to know what the experience is like for right. the patient. But we also go just because we're people and we have struggles too.
Is it different when therapists see therapists, would you say?
I think it is. There's a tendency, I think, to sort of backseat drive, you know, to say, you know, I wouldn't do it that way.
Right, right.
But I think also you're a person in that room. And I had the same reaction to my therapist that I think my patients have to me, which is that I wanted him to like me. If I saw another patient in the waiting room, I wondered, you know, is her session more interesting than mine?
When I read in the book, at one point you wrote that you were thinking that you wanted to reveal something to your therapist, but you were thinking, should I say that? How would I react if one of my patients said that? So I wonder if that almost can get in your way in a therapy session, being a therapist and thinking, you know, not being able to differentiate between being clinician and being patient sometimes.
Yeah, I think you really have to just be a person in the room and take your therapist hat off.
Yeah. You do write about establishing a bond with your therapist, who you start to see after you break up with a man who you thought you were going to marry, and it's an awful breakup. And you say that what got you to see a therapist was what you called a presenting problem. But that's not always the reason why people go to therapy, really. Can you explain that, right? Am I saying that
right?
Yeah, okay.
That's right. Yeah. People come to therapy for usually a specific reason, but usually that's just kind of a red herring. So the reason that they come in, whether it's a breakup or, you know, some relational problem or whatever might be going on, is usually there's something underneath that got them there in the first place. So I always say that I'm listening not just to the lyrics, but to the music under the lyrics. I want to hear sort of what is the struggle underneath.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a little bit about this, and this is in your book. I'm wondering if you could read that excerpt for us.
Sure. So here I'm talking about my therapist and his reaction to the presenting problem. He knows that most people are brilliant at finding ways to filter out the things that they don't want to look at using distractions or defenses to keep threatening feelings at bay. He knows that pushing aside emotions only makes them stronger, but that before he goes in and destroys somebody's defense, whether that defense is obsessing over another person or pretending not to see what's in plain sight, he needs to help the patient replace the defense with something else so that he doesn't leave the person raw and exposed with no protection whatsoever.
Hmm. So you go in, your presenting problem is a breakup, but what was your real reason?
I think the real reason was that he says to me in the first session, I don't think you're just grieving this breakup. I think you're grieving something bigger. And I was really going through this midpoint in my life where I was looking for more meaning and I was trying to sort of assess what it was that I wanted once my sort of the future that I had imagined had fallen apart.
Hmm. And did he help you do that?
He did help me do that, although I was not necessarily on board at the beginning. And I think that that happens a lot when people come to therapy, is that a therapist will hold up a mirror to you and show you your reflection so that you can see the ways that you're shooting yourself in the foot and ending up in the same place over and over. But sometimes we don't necessarily want to see that reflection at first.
Right. It sounds like it could take a long time, too.
It doesn't always. I think there's this misconception that once you come to therapy, you're sort of stuck there for years. And that's not really what we want for people. We want them to be independent, and we want to help them get through their struggles as quickly as possible.
How do you get people to trust you enough to be able to let you get them to a vulnerable spot so they can do some of those, make some of those changes and examine themselves honestly?
Right. I think partly they have to be ready to change. So I think for people who come to therapy and think that the therapist is going to fix their problems need to know that they need to make changes out in the world. But in terms of establishing the bond, I think that you have to be real and honest and human in the room with the person.
Hmm. And so then how do you peel back the layers, too, and make sure that folks who have something, especially something that might be painful, that they don't want to talk about it in a gentle way so you're not overwhelming them and also helping them address it at the same time?
I think that a lot of people come into therapy with secrets, and there are the secrets that they keep from the world, and there are the secrets that they keep from the people close to them, but there are also the secrets that they keep from their therapist, and then there are the secrets they keep from themselves. And we're really working with the secrets that they're keeping from us and the secrets that they're keeping from themselves. And you can't just go in there and kind of expose people to something that they're not ready for. So I think you kind of come in through the back door. You kind of plant seeds along the way so that they'll be ready to talk about it later. It's almost like I used to compete in chess, and it's a little bit like that where you're thinking sort of five moves ahead.
You know, you start the book with I would say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, a difficult patient named John.
Yes.
And you're struggling to have compassion for John. He's got some difficulties and some difficult personality things going on. What do you do in a situation like that when you have a difficult patient? And when does it get to a point, if ever, you sort of have to end it with the cleave, to terminate therapy with this client because maybe it's not going to work?
Yeah. John was this incredibly abrasive person. The first thing that he says to me is that he chose me because I was a nobody, so he wouldn't run into any of his Hollywood producer colleagues in my waiting room. And then he goes on to tell me that he doesn't want his wife to know that he's in therapy, so he hands me this wad of cash and says, I'll be just like his mistress. So he wasn't the most
charming guy to begin with. But what I think the ways that people behave are their ways of managing. It's their ways of coping with the unspeakable for them. And John ends up, I think, in the book becoming the person that people end up liking the most. And he's somebody that I came to really feel genuine affection for. Because when you see the trauma and the tragedy underneath, you really start to, it draws you in and you really start to connect with him and you see what made him act that way in the first place.
Mm. And what about, does it ever get to the point where you say, you know, this person's just too abrasive and it's not going to work? Do you have to end it with a and it may yeah. this be a personality issue or not right. being able to connect. Does it happen and how do you deal with that?
Rarely, but it does happen. In the book, I talk about somebody that I did terminate therapy with. She found me very unhelpful, and I felt really helpless, and I spoke to colleagues about it. I went to consultation group and tried to get feedback, but whatever anybody's suggestions were, she rejected, and I felt like I was wasting her time, and yet she didn't want to leave. She would tell me how incompetent I was, but still wanted to stay, and I would try to talk about that with her, but I just couldn't get through, and I feel like that was my failure. I feel like I didn't want to waste her time, but I did terminate. But I still feel like I wish that I had found a way to reach her. Hmm.
You write about a patient of yours in the book who's an older woman, and she really wants to change her life in a year, or she may do something drastic. And you say that it's difficult for older adults to get mental health services. Can you expand on that a little bit? Why is that, and what should older adults do?
I think older adults tend to be often more isolated. I think that they have different ideas culturally about what therapy is, and maybe there's more stigma for them, so they don't necessarily come to therapy. Often if they're retired, they might not have the means to come to therapy, and so they end up going to clinics where there are, you know, the 20-somethings who are training, and I think it's very hard for somebody who's 70 to relate to somebody who's 20 in the same way. They haven't lived enough life yet. And so I think there are a lot of barriers for older adults, and they're dealing with a lot of issues that other people aren't yet. So a lot of their friends are dying. They're dealing with their own health issues. There's a lot of loss as you get older. And also there's a lot that has already happened in their lives. So the window for the future is shorter. And in terms of what you can change, I think that the picture sometimes looks different. But what was beautiful about that story was she was 69 years old and she had made quite a mess of her life. Her adult children didn't talk to her. She'd had a few marriages. She was incredibly isolated. And she made tremendous changes, even more than I think, you know, anybody had anticipated in that year. So I feel like it's never too late to change.
Mm. You also write a beautiful story about Julie, who's one of your patients who's diagnosed with cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about Julie, too?
Julie was in her early 30s and had just gotten married, and she felt something in her breast on her honeymoon and came back, and it was discovered that it was breast cancer. And it was a very treatable form of breast cancer, and she came to me to kind of help cope with the treatment as she was newly married. And she went through treatment. It seemed to be fine. And 6 months later, she had a very aggressive form of cancer, and she got a terminal diagnosis. And she asked me to stay with her until she died. And I had never done anything like that. And I wasn't sure I was the right person to do that because she was only going to get one chance at this. And I wanted her to have the best possible care. But she really wanted me because she didn't want to be part of what she called sort of the pink ribbons and the optimism and the affirmation world was not the approach that she wanted. And we went through that experience together of helping her to come to terms with her death.
Hmm. What did you take from that?
It made me very aware of my mortality. And I think that it's good in a certain way to be aware of it because I think that you live more intentionally. I think that you don't put things off for the future that you ordinarily think you have this long time horizon to do. Julie would always say, all of the people around who would plan, they would say things like, in 3 years we're going to buy a house, or I'm going to apply for a new job in a few years, or, you know, all these things that people would do later. And she said, you know, you don't need a diagnosis of cancer to know that you might not have later, that now is now.
Yeah. You write that the future is as much of a factor in therapy as the past.
It is. I think that the past is a fixture of therapy in the sense that we want to understand our past so that it doesn't trap us. And then how can we write a different next chapter? But I think that people focus on the past and the present a lot. But when your present falls apart, like in my case, this idea that I was going to have a future with this person and I wasn't, all of a sudden, it wasn't just that I was missing him in the present, it was that I was missing the future that now was not going to happen. Mm. And I think that happens with grief of all kinds. When people have a miscarriage or somebody close to them dies, they're not just missing them in the day-to-day, they're missing all of the future that they would have had with that person.
I wonder, you know, you mentioned that it might be difficult for older adults to relate to some folks who are younger. And also in your book, you write about an older therapist colleague of yours, a 7-year-old man who was counseling a younger woman who wanted to know about, you know, raising children and becoming pregnant. And he thought, maybe I'm not the best person to give her advice about what's going on in the world right now. I wonder, what are some of your main pieces of advice to people in trying to find a therapist that they could connect with?
So research shows that more than a therapist's training or their years of experience or the modality that they're using, the most important factor in the success of someone's therapy is the relationship with the therapist. It's very important that people find the right therapist. So most therapists structure the first session as a consultation where it's a chance for somebody to come in and get a feel for what it's like to be in a room with that therapist. And I think the questions to ask yourself at the end of that session are, did I feel understood? Did I feel like I could talk to this person? And if you felt that way, then you should go back.
All right. Lori Gottlieb, psychotherapist, author of the new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're broadcasting live from WBUR City Space. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call, but give it a try. 617-917-4717.